Well, welcome everyone to Stars, Cells, and God, a podcast where we talk about the latest discoveries in the Book of Nature that give us more evidence for the reliability and truth of the Book of Scripture and for the Christian faith. And if you're not already a subscriber to our YouTube channel, go to YouTube. You can subscribe for free. We post all these podcasts there and other venues as well. Well, today I'm joined by Jeff Zwierink. And, Jeff, we're kind of mixing up a bit today. You're going to talk about something that's more theoretical and in your area of discipline, astronomy and cosmology. I'm going to talk about something more observational outside of my discipline. I'm going to talk about geophysics and paleontology, life sciences, etc. So we've got a good mix here. But how about if you start off first about the discovery or theoretical development that you want to discuss?
Well, thanks, Hugh. I appreciate the time to be here. And, one of the things, you're talking about how what we find as we study creation and how that points to the truth of Scripture. And one of the things that I see in Scripture that virtually all Christians agree on is that the universe began to exist. They can argue about where does the Bible talk about that, and but you start out in Genesis 1. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. And I loved the first time I heard your description of that it's not God created the heavens and God created the earth, that God is creating the totality of the physical realm,
right?
All the space, time, matter, and energy. And it seems like that's a pervasive theme throughout Scripture, that regardless of the time scales or whatever you're dealing with, that there is a place where, the way I would describe it is, if you run time backwards, eventually you run into a boundary where nothing exists. The challenge, though, in doing that is, as a scientist, you say, how would you measure the beginning of the universe? Well, if you talk about the beginning of Jeff Zwierink, that's not too hard, because you can take measurements where Jeff Zwierink did and Jeff Zwierink didn't exist. But by definition, we can't measure something before the universe. And so what does that actually look like? And even going back to the late 1980s, where I first was introduced to some of your work, realizing that there are these theorems that scientists can develop that show that as you run time backwards, you run into this boundary, if you will. And I wrote a book on Escaping the Beginning. It really helped me articulate and understand what it is scientists are doing that weigh in on whether the universe had a beginning. It's not measuring T equals zero. It's asking the question, how far back does the universe go, and is there a place where there's a boundary? And one of the things that you had commented in your book was, I think it was Fingerprint of God was where I first saw it, was that there are these singularity theorems where, the Hawking-Penrose singularity theorem is probably the most popular that's talked about, where, again, if you run time backwards, eventually you run into this beginning. But every one of those singularity theorems has a set of preconditions to it, or set of conditions. And so that particular one has the notion that general relativity is valid, and that energy behaves a certain way, that effectively there's more gravitational energy than repulsive gravitational energy.
And you also need some mass in the universe.
Well, that plays into that energy condition.
Right. Yeah.
And so, but what that means is that, as powerful as that theorem is, if general relativity is not correct, or if energy doesn't behave a certain way, the theorem no longer applies. And so I realize that a lot of this discussion about the beginning of the universe is asking the question, what are the sorts of theorems we can develop, and do they actually apply? And you and I both know that as of this point in time, that energy condition is violated by inflation. And so if inflation happened, the Hawking-Penrose singularity theorem no longer applies to the universe. Well, what I find, the particular paper that I wanted to talk about, it was a paper called "The Generalized Second Law Implies a Quantum Singularity Theorem" by Aaron Wall. And he's addressing that particular issue of, okay, the singularity theorems of Hawking and Penrose don't apply to the beginning because inflation violates the energy condition. And quite honestly, a lot of scientists, myself included, think something beyond general relativity is needed. And so it may be that quantum gravity theory, that singularity theorem no longer applies if quantum gravity is a correct
This is an extension to the theorem from Arvin Bordé, Alan Guth, and Alexander Vilenkin, where they took on the inflationary issue this is actually going beyond that.
Well, it's in that class of developments, and it's actually going back to not so much the Hawking-Penrose theorem, but Penrose had another theorem that was just relied on the second law of thermodynamics to argue that there's a pass boundary. But again, you run into this question or this problem where you're dealing with quantum mechanical effects that the theorem no longer holds. And so what Aaron Wall was trying to do is say, well, when you're dealing with black holes, because that's where a lot of this work is developed, and right. then what goes forward in a black hole generally is applying in reverse as you're dealing with time in the universe, was developing a generalized second law of thermodynamics where you're talking about the amount of entropy and what do we know. And it turns out there's different ways of looking at entropy. You can look at entropy as the amount of stuff that I don't know, which is one way of looking at entropy, or there's a you can look at entropy as the amount of stuff that can just cannot be known, which the latter is a more constant quantity, which what I don't know can change and grow over time. And so he's just looking at generalizing that law of entropy or how entropy behaves. And the bottom line of what he's found out is that he can develop this generalized second law, which applies to applies to singularities and event horizons. And the reason that why he wanted to do this was to investigate, does this strengthen or weaken the singularity theorems developed by Penrose? And lo and behold, what he found was that this generalization of the second law actually strengthens the case for there being a beginning.
Right.
Now, it does raise some interesting things because that second or that theorem by Penrose only applies if the universe is spatially infinite. And so, this generalized second law would apply a singularity, assuming the universe is spatially infinite. But, I think that's a reasonable way to look at our universe. And despite the fact that theologians and philosophers and mathematicians and physicists all look at infinities very differently and whether they can exist or not. But what I find, the thing that I found fascinating and encouraging about this is there's this idea out there in cosmology and in the scientific discussion today that once we find that proper quantum theory of gravity, we're no longer going to have a beginning and by implication, the Bible will inaccurately describe the universe. What this paper is showing is that even though we don't have that proper theory of gravity yet, quantum theory of gravity, there's still a lot of indications that when we do find it, that these singularity theorems are still going to hold. We're going to have evidence of a singularity. And that points to the idea that the Bible is correct. And it actually shows that when we start incorporating those quantum effects into our models and to our calculations, we still get the singularities. And so it kind of strengthens the case. At the very minimum, it makes the case that it's reasonable to think that there's a singularity and the Bible describes creation accurately. And if the last 100 years is accurate, the more we investigate, the stronger that conclusion is going to be. So I just found that a pretty exciting, encouraging, and fascinating discovery.
Yeah, it is great. I mean, looking at what he wrote there, it's like he says, okay, it depends on the universe being spatially infinite. We'll never know that because there's a limit to how accurately we can measure the geometry of the universe.
Right.
It measures flat to about 4 places of the decimal. That's about as best we're ever going to do. But I noted what he wrote there was that, hey, that's good enough. The fact that it's close, we got flat to 4 places of decimal, that still means that this theorem is in good shape because we know it's not a closed system to a high degree.
Right. So, well, what I like about this is that, and even as I've read some stuff that Wallace said about this, it's not like he's saying, oh, I've proved that there's a beginning. What he said is that, here's a way to look at things. We know we need to expand general relativity to include quantum mechanical effects into gravity. Here's an approach of how to think about that, particularly looking at the second law of thermodynamics and how entropy behaves. And noting that even in quantum mechanical situations or the quantum mechanical places where it shows in, there are weak quantum mechanical effects. And so it gives a reason to think that this particular theorems, even when extended where we have that full quantum theory of gravity, are still going to apply, that those new developments aren't going to invalidate this, assuming this generalized second law is a way to look at it. And so it in total, it provides an argument that as we find that quantum theory of gravity, it really is going to point to a beginning, which is to me provides a response to the people who say, you know, hey, I can find this quantum theory of gravity might be correct, and it doesn't have a beginning, and this one and it doesn't have a beginning, and this one and it doesn't have a beginning. And my question in that has kind of always been, it doesn't surprise me that you can find quantum theories of gravity that don't have a beginning. But what I don't know is, if you're going to make a conclusion, you got to say, of the types of theories that are out there, which ones have a beginning and which ones don't. What this paper is showing is that there's a large class of quantum theories of gravity that are still going to point to, there's this singularity that points
moreover,
to a beginning.
Moreover, they're the ones that look the most reasonable.
Well, if yeah. God created things, that's what I'm going to expect. You know, you always like to put predictions on things. As we investigate more, the ones that have the singularities are going to be the ones that match the observations we make. Now, it may take 100 years to get observations on what that quantum theory of gravity is going to be, but nonetheless, I expect that to hold true.
Yeah, moreover, we may never get a complete quantum gravity theory. So, however, as we're pushing, we're seeing that it's going in a theistic direction. I presume you've been following, too, the exchanges between Aaron Wall and Sean Carroll. That's been going on for, the past 6 years. There are different theorems going, because he's,
right.
Sean Carroll's got the quantum eternity theorem.
Right.
Aaron Wall's got his, theorem based on the second law of thermodynamics.
Right.
And I have appreciated that their dialogue with one another has been respectful.
Mm-hmm.
That's been good. But what caught my attention as an astronomer is it seems like what's separating them is that Sean Carroll needs the quantum space-time fluctuations in the quantum gravity era to be really large.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have the second law of thermodynamics applying, they wouldn't be that large.
Okay.
And what's exciting about that is actually something that's potentially testable.
Right.
In the sense that that has impacts on the event horizons of black holes. It also has effects on the image quality of distant quasars and blazars. Mm-hmm. And there's already been observations that have been made that says, hey, we know that these quantum space-time fluctuations can't be extremely large.
Mm-hmm.
So it's basically pushing the realm of speculation for people like Sean Carroll into a smaller box. 10 years ago, they had a little more room to speculate. Now they've got a lot less room to speculate.
Well, as I look at this, to me, this raises something that as a scientist, it makes sense that it happens. But I think it's something that when you look outside, or people looking outside could draw the wrong conclusion, is that, you've got Sean Carroll, who's a very talented scientist. I really like and enjoy, personally, I just enjoy listening to and engaging his work. But, very accomplished and very talented scientist. You got Aaron Wall, I put in the same category. You got these two people that seem to come at this with a different worldview that in some sense, and this isn't a pejorative, but it looks very weird, is that I think in some sense, Sean Carroll wants to find a universe where there isn't a beginning. And my suspicion is Wall probably wants to find a universe where there is a beginning. And they've both been pretty upfront about that declaration.
Well, they've laid their theological cards on the table.
Exactly. So it's... there's this idea that science is kind of done almost robotically by Spock, never let any sort of preference or emotional thing get in the way. And the reality is people are scientists, or scientists are people. And here they have, you really are kind of testing these worldviews and battling it out, because I think whether there's a beginning or not, if you have a naturalistic worldview or a theistic worldview, that you're going to get different conclusions on whether there's a beginning there or not, which of those is going to be correct. And to have that battle out, that there's ways to have that discussion scientifically that upholds the integrity of science, but yet there are still these worldview issues at play. And I think I don't want to leave the impression that, scientists are just driven by what they want to believe. I think that would be an easy conclusion, but wrong conclusion to draw. But I'm just kind of curious, what are your thoughts on that? Because it does seem like there are worldview issues in play more than just kind of this objective scientific enterprise.
Well, I always like to put things to some kind of a test.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really praying that before the Hubble Space Telescope finally stops functioning, it will.
Yeah.
It's been amazing how long it's been functioning. But one more thing I really want them to make sure they do, because that Hubble Space Telescope can make observations at relatively short ultraviolet wavelengths.
Mm-hmm.
And they've used it already to put a limit on these quantum space-time fluctuations observing a blazar 3 billion light years away.
Right.
And they saw that the image was sharp, which means the quantum space-time fluctuations can't be large. But the more distantly you observe an object, and the shorter the wavelength you observe the object, the better constraint you get.
Right.
The Hubble Space Telescope can do the same thing at 10 or 12 billion light years. Mm-hmm. So let's get it done.
The exciting thing is, and what I love about science, it's not that worldviews don't come into play, but as you're saying, there's ways to go out and test it.
There's ways to go out and test it.
Science is not a bunch of objective people doing things. Science is a bunch of people who have thoughts and beliefs about what's going on, but who are willing to subject their ideas to scrutiny to see which ones match the real world. And that is what I love about what Reasons to Believe is about. It's about, hey, how can we go out and test and show that Christianity is a true belief, not a just something we believe because we want to.
Well, something else I'll say about worldview that I think we're on the same page with is that, hey, these worldviews can be tested, but we can never, I mean, I run into atheist scientists who say, I'm not going to believe in your God until we know all possible speculation that would support a non-God existence or ruled out. And it's like, that'll never happen.
Mm-hmm.
That's like coming to me and saying, hey, provide me with absolute proof that my wife exists.
Mm-hmm.
I got lots of practical proof, but not absolute proof. And so if that's a condition, I can never satisfy that.
Right.
On the other hand, we can say, hey, we are pushing back the frontiers of scientific knowledge. As we push back those frontiers, how is your worldview doing? And if it's not meeting the pushback of the frontiers, maybe you need to give serious consideration to an alternate worldview. So I'm excited about these advances in theoretical astrophysics, as well as these advances in what the Hubble Space Telescope can do to put constraints on this, because I think it might encourage people, okay, I've been backed up into a smaller corner of speculation. Maybe I need to reconsider my worldview.
Yeah, I'm excited about what's going on. And you know, it's just interesting. I've been doing science long enough that I can see how ideas that were very prevalent have changed dramatically. I mean, you know, even just the idea of a multiverse or inflation, those were talked about but not really accepted ideas. And just how as science has progressed, the thoughts on whether those are true and correct has really changed. So I'm kind of excited about that.
Well, I am too.
You've been doing it longer than I have.
I have, but I'm just looking. I mean, for example, inflation. I think we're really close to determining what kind of inflation event happened.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm excited about the fine tuning that's going to reveal.
Right.
So we live in exciting times.
It is.
This is my favorite century to live in. I'm glad I'm living in it.
Fair point. So, well, hey, I know you've got a discussion about oxygen, if I remember correctly.
Yeah, so this is completely different from theoretical astrophysics. It's a paper that got published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences, 12 authors. It was published literally just February 8th, so just a few days ago this got published. And to kind of put it in context, I'm going to have people see a slide that I prepared here, and probably a lot of you have seen this slide before. It's in a lot of my talks, but I want you to pay attention. This is the oxygenation history of Earth's atmosphere. Where for the first 2.5 billion years, the oxygen content was like about 1/10,000th of what it is today.
So this graph is even wrong because it shows it about 1% there when it's really effectively nothing.
It is way below that, but yeah.
I gotcha.
I couldn't use a logarithmic scale, so that's what I did. So it was really low, and then you got what's called the great oxygenation event. Where it bumps up anywhere from 1 to 2 to 3%,
right,
oxygen content in the atmosphere. But I want you to look at that dotted line. That dotted line above 1.5 billion years is a region where we just don't have good data on what the oxygen content in Earth's atmosphere was. And this paper addresses that. It says, finally, we got a proxy for oxygen that is reliable, that tells us what's going on in that dotted line area. And this has significant consequences for how we interpret the fossil record and how we determine, okay, what's responsible for the big changes in life on planet Earth.
Well, if I could ask a question, it's hard to, you mentioned that there for that period of time, it seems odd that we have it for way back 4 billion years ago, but we don't have it 1 billion years ago. What is it that makes that particular era challenging to find the oxygen content? And quite honestly, how do you find it 4 billion years ago? It's not like you got samples of atmosphere.
It's not, but would you have these proxies?
And this explain what a proxy is.
It's basically a measurement that has a correlation with what you want to measure.
Okay.
So, I mean, a given example, if you want to measure, the temperature in the last few thousand years, you can look at the ratio of oxygen 16 to 17 to 18, and that'll tell you the temperature in the atmosphere. So that's how we get global mean temperatures from ice cores, for example.
So presumably in that last 2.7 to 4 billion years, it's just been hard to find something that we can measure that correlates with oxygen content. And this is what this paper is addressing.
This is what this paper's addressed. Basically, it's making the point that why we have a dotted line there is that the proxies we've been using are the abundance of cerium in sediments just off the shores of the continents, and then also looking at chromium. Those are the two that we've been used. And about six pages of this paper is explaining why that's been problematic.
Okay.
Why we've had to put a dotted line there, because some of the measurements indicate, hey, we may have as much as a 5% oxygen in the atmosphere. Measurements in a different area at the same time say, no, it's down around 0.1%. So okay. You got literally a factor of 100 difference. And so they pulled in cerium. They said, hey, it's just as problematic. Well, what this paper is introducing, it says, we've found a proxy that gets rid of all these problems. And it's iron 2.
Okay.
And the value of iron is an abundant element in Earth. You know, 5% of the Earth is iron. And iron's everywhere.
Right.
And iron 2 especially gives you a good measure of how much oxygen is in the upper part of the ocean. And the interest here is that the first evidence for animal life is in the shallow ocean environments.
Okay.
And so they're basically looking at sediments offshore where you've got shallow ocean water, looking at the amount of iron 2, and say this will tell you whether you got partial oxidation of the sediments or complete oxidation.
Mm-hmm.
If you got complete oxidation, you're looking at 8% oxygen in the atmosphere or more. If you got less, you got quite a bit. And if it's really partial everywhere, it means you're way below 1%.
Okay, so basically they've got something they can measure, because its sedimentation is going to stick around for a while.
Right.
That will sample what the oxygenation of the ocean is, which is correlated with what's going on in the atmosphere.
Exactly.
And it's ubiquitous in that it's all around the Earth. It's also in the particular environment where animals first appeared. And so it's a good measure of the amount of oxygen, and allows you to tell if it's fully oxidized, that means we've got oxygen content in the atmosphere 8% or more, and then presumably you can get some sort of measure of how much based on how oxidized it is. That's the basic process.
Okay. And then like cerium and chromium, it's a complete record.
Okay.
Because iron is so abundant, you're going to have the proxy, because that was the problem with the cerium is it's a relatively rare element. And it may be that just isn't any at all in that environment.
Gotcha.
Which case you don't get a measurement.
Well, yeah, and that does, you know, my immediate question when you said you found it in places, well, it's lower here and higher there. Are you measuring just regional effects? Whereas with the iron, presumably its ubiquity allows you to get a much better handle on that.
That's exactly what's going on. That's why this paper is so exciting, because it says, okay, we can get rid of that dotted line.
Nice, okay.
And we actually know what's going on. And what they discovered was, you got less than 0.2% oxygen in the atmosphere from the end of the great oxygenation event, which is about 2.6 billion years after the formation of the Earth, up until 900. They know from about 2 billion years ago,
okay,
to about 900,000 years ago, it was definitely less than 0.2% oxygen in the atmosphere everywhere on the Earth.
Okay, so from about 2 billion years ago to about
900,000.
900,000, 900,000, 900 million. I
900,
assume about a billion years ago.
pardon me, 900 million.
Yeah, okay, all right,
900 million,
okay.
sorry. Thank you
Okay,
for correcting
so for
that.
that billion years, we know it's fairly low, is what they're saying.
Saying it's really, yeah, quite
Okay.
low. And then from 900 million years to 750 million years, they see it going up slightly.
Okay.
Although the debate is, did it start 900 million years ago, or did it start 750 million years ago? But they do see that something's happening in that range.
Right.
So we need more measurements to determine exactly when the onset is. But when they look at the fossil record, they notice that you start moving from just microbes to, really tiny eukaryotic life forms. And those are the life forms that need more than 0.2% oxygen in the atmosphere. They begin to show up somewhere between 690 and 700 million years ago. And so the paper ends by saying we see a really tight correlation between the amount of oxygen in the atmosphere and the minimum oxygen that these creatures need and when they appear.
So that seems to be the place where this okay might connect with what scripture has to say.
Yes.
Because if I get what you're saying, the creature, the larger the animals, the eukaryotic and larger organisms, they need oxygen because that's basically what allows higher energy transfer to happen. It's a little more complicated than that, but so the mapping the oxygen content of the atmosphere is really important because that's going to weigh in on when could these animals exist. And so what's the connection with what scripture has to say there? So we know the larger bodied animals need oxygen. We now know that there wasn't any oxygen in this period. So what?
Well, what this paper is showing is that the moment you got enough oxygen to support small eukaryotic life forms, they show up right away.
Okay.
Which means that there's no time delay between the conditions that are necessary for those life forms to exist and when they appear. And then you see in this graph that you got a sudden jump from about, oh, 1.5% up to 8%. That's called the abelian explosion. Where you now no longer have these tiny eukaryotic life forms or tiny sponges. Some sponges can get by with less than 8% oxygen. There's some evidence in the fossil record they show up previous to 575 million years ago. But 575 million years ago is when you have this sudden proliferation of animals that are as big as 2 meters across.
Right.
But they're animals without digestive tracts.
Okay.
Without a circulatory system. They're basically filter feeding animals. Think of giant sponges, jellyfish type creatures. Those are the
So these
ones
are
that
not
show
cats
up.
and dogs. These are
No.
much more primitive, large but still relatively primitive
They're large,
animals.
relatively primitive, but they need 8% oxygen to
Gotcha. Okay.
survive. But the moment we get 8% oxygen, they suddenly appear, and they suddenly appear in great diversity. It's not like you just get a single species.
So it seems like the significance of this is, okay, we measure that there are these large organisms in the Avalon and then ultimately in the Cambrian where the oxygen levels go up. If the oxygen levels had been up higher, oh, there's an environment, things could evolve and become in there. The fact that it happens, the oxygenation seems to correspond almost with when they show up. It's not like they're just developing. It's like, well, the way I say, God's prepared it and then he introduced the animals.
Yeah, what a lot of non-theistic evolutionary biologists speculated is the oxygen jumped up first, then there was a period of time in which evolution allowed the appearance of animal life forms that could actually take advantage of that oxygen.
Because presumably those are some pretty significant changes to be able to use oxygen as energy
Oh,
as opposed to
yeah,
not oxygen.
right. Yeah, these are major changes. And of course, from a non-theistic perspective, you're going to need a lot of time for mutations and natural selection, gene exchange, epigenetics to be able to transform these
Right.
creatures where they can take advantage of that oxygen. This is demonstrating we don't see any time. the moment the oxygen hits that minimum level, these creatures appear.
Okay, so presumably the thought would have been from the great oxidation event where you got 1, maybe 2% of oxygen, that for the next couple billion, or that billion years, the oxygen would have just steadily increased up to 8%, which gives time for animals to adjust and adapt and evolve to the increasing oxygen. What this paper is showing is that while the great oxidation event went up, it dropped back down to very low levels and remained that up until about 900 million years
ago.
Jeff,
this is actually related to the discovery you were talking about, because what you have are people from a non-theistic perspective taking advantage of regions of ignorance.
Okay.
So just like, okay, hey, we don't really know what's going on to any great degree of precision in the quantum gravity era. Therefore, we think we're free to speculate non-theistic ideas. Same thing happened here. People took a look at that dotted line and said, oh, well, maybe things weren't low. Maybe we had lots of oxygen in that area, in that time region, and that would give us the time we need for naturalistic models to produce what they do.
Well, that seems like actually a really good a way to approach it scientifically, is to say, okay, we've got this measurement, and if our non-theistic model is correct, we would expect this to happen. And so then the idea is, then let's go out and figure out how to test it, and found it out. And lo and behold, the test seems to indicate that the requirements they were looking for weren't there.
Right. And for 30 years, geophysicists and geochemists have been wanting to get that data.
Mm-hmm.
Now we have it. I mean, it's been a long wait. And so I've been showing this dotted line for a good 20 years. I don't have to show a dotted line anymore.
You can put the rest of the dots
can't you? Exactly, yeah. So I'm excited about this.
Well, I mean, you know, both of these discoveries, what I find fascinating about them are that there's... Yeah, you could put that in a very pejorative explanation. Oh, there are people who don't want God to exist, and they're just putting forth all these theories to get away from God. But the reality of what, as I read what they're doing, is they're saying, hey, if we're going to make an explanation that works, this is what's going to have to happen. And that actually provides provides a hypothesis, if you will, that we can go out and test. And it helps direct where our experiments go. What I find exciting is that as we do those tests, it seems to confirm what I would expect from a theistic perspective. But it's really exciting that, you know, both theistic and non-theistic scientists are engaging in these topics and helping drive knowledge forward so that we can we have more information to make a decision on how things actually work. That's pretty exciting, kind of regardless of which conclusion you end up with.
It is. And that's kind of the mission of science. Get rid of all the dotted lines.
Right.
Or as many as we can.
Right. Well, that's a pretty cool discovery, Hugh. I appreciate you sharing that with us.
Oh, yeah, well, good. Well, this kind of wraps up our episode of Stars, Cells, and God. And I encourage you to go to our YouTube channel. We post all these there. You can look at them anytime you want. And then go to RTB underscore official. That's where you can engage our ministry through social media. And Jeff, I know you've got a Facebook and Twitter page. I've got one. All the scholars here have one. You can go there and post questions. Don't guarantee we're going to answer them right away, but we'll do the best we can to answer your questions. So please visit those different sites. Thanks.